We now begin a new Masechta. This is Maseches Ksuvos, and this will be the basic introduction to the Masechta. The Masechta is named after the marriage contract called the Ksuba, which I'm sure most everyone is already familiar with. The Ksuba means something which is written down, quite literally, and it is essentially a document which protects a wife in the event that her husband divorces her or that he dies, that she should have certain financial protections. So in the Ksuba are set forth the various rights and responsibilities, really the rights of the woman and responsibilities the husband has to her, primarily, to protect her. Now, the origins of the Ksuba are actually a machlokas, whether it's doraisa or medurabanan, that is to say, whether the obligation is from the Torah or only rabbinic in nature. Those who point to the doraisa obligation cite the verse which says, It's a pasuk in Shmos, Perik Tes Zayin, pasuk Chav Beis, I believe, which talks about how, in certain scenarios, a man must give kesef yishkol kamor habesulos. He has to give this woman who he victimized an amount of silver like mohar habesulos, like the marriage contract, the mohar marriage contract of besulos, virgins, and they cite that as a source that there is such a thing as a mohar, a ksuba, a marriage contract that goes to women when they get married, as a besula. The truth is that even those who hold that it's a doraisa in nature agree it only applies to women who are besulos. Now, never married before, in other words. The actual amount of the ksuba, which for a besula is said to be 200 zuz, a zuz being the same as a dinar, is actually learned out from a drasha of this from the psukim here, because the amount that the silver that this man will be giving to this woman is 50 shekalim of the Torah, and the shekel of the Torah is equal to it's equivalent of the sela of the Mishnah, and therefore dinarim or 4 zuz to 1 sela. So if it's 50 shekel, meaning 50 sela in the psukim, we mean 200 zuz, 200 dinar, time of the Mishnah. Because that's the basis of that. Now, most others learn that the obligation to give a ksuba to one's wife is a rabbinic obligation. And the rationale is, shlote kala be'enav lehotzia, that it shouldn't be a light matter for a man to divorce his wife. You'll recall that before Rabbeinu Gershom came on the scene in the, it's called 11th century, early 11th century, in Europe, the halacha is, min haTorah, that a man may divorce a woman, his wife, bal korcha, without her consent. So that being the case, the woman needed some protection. And the rabbi said, the woman is protected by having this significant financial disincentive, that if he would divorce her, he has to pay her out this ksuva money, which is, let's call it now, 200 zuz. 200 zuz in the time of the Mishnah, you can see from what we learn in Maseches Peah, that it's roughly speaking the amount of money that a person would need to provide for all his needs for a year, a calendar year. So it's a good amount of money in the time of the Mishnah, and that's the rationale here, that she should be protected. Of course, the Ksuba has a payout both in the event of divorce or upon his death. So the death payout, like life insurance, if you will, comparable to life insurance, is certainly not something which would fit into the rubric of Shlote kala be'enav lehotzia, not wanting to divorce her, get rid of her. But the idea is that the rabbis wanted to protect women and to give them incentive to get married. And since a major driving force behind the woman getting married is to ensure she is protected, financially and otherwise, so therefore, one of the important protections she needs to be given is not just that she won't be divorced, but also in the event of her husband's death, that she'll be protected financially. And therefore, in the death as well, she gets paid out this, I'll call it 200 zuz. Now, that 200 zuz number, first of all, whether, again, doraisa, durabanan, interestingly, doraisa, there are those who point to a remez in the verse, because the word kamohar, like the marriage contract with besulos, you could read it as kamohar spelt chaf mem hei, resh. So chaf mem hei spells kama, how much, resh is the number, is the letter for 200 in gematria, so it's like 200 zuz. And that 200 zuz is the basic obligation that a man has to provide for a woman in the ksuba if she is a besula. She's never slept with a man before. If she's no longer a basula, she's a widow, divorcee, etc., so then the standard ksuba is 100 zuz. So that number, 100 or 200 zuz, is called ikar ksuba, the essential ksuba, and that number is set by what's called Tanai Bezdin. In other words, the rabbi said, that's the absolute bare minimum, and there's no possibility of the ksuba going below that number. So, meaning, some ksubos and sometimes places actually were just written Tanai Basin as opposed to giving an exact number. But that number is the bottom number, lower threshold. So that means, hypothetically, if a woman entered into ksuba, and you see like on the ksuba, you know, so to speak, it says she's getting 25 zuz, and she's initialed it, and she agrees, and there's a big red line through the, you know, the 100, and it's written 25, whatever the story is, makes no difference. 200 for first-time marriages, basulos, and 100 for non-basulos, second-time marriages, is an actual bare minimum, regardless of what's written in the ksuba, but there's the possibility of what's called tosefes ksuba. They could supplement, they could add more. So the ksuba could be not just for 200, but for, you know, 2 million zuz, if the husband's agreeable. Now, when a woman enters into a marriage, she is likely to bring with her a dowry, stuff. She has assets that she brings to the marriage. So those assets, as part of the unit of marriage, can be treated in one of two ways. Either they're called nechse tzon barzel or nechse malug. Nechse, meaning nechasim, are property. And the property can be characterized in one of two ways. The tzon barzel, which literally means tzon is like a flock of animals, like of cattle, of sheep and goats. And barzel is iron. So these are iron sheep. The idea being that if her asset she brings in, let's say hypothetically and commonly was, say, a flock of sheep. So she brings a flock of sheep in. The problem with the flock of sheep is, you know, if everything goes well, the sheep can make babies, and there can be lots of flocks of sheep with many, many sheep, and they can produce lots of wool, etc., etc. But it could also happen that in one night, you know, there's a lightning storm and they all die, or the wolves get them, or the bandits rob them, or whatever the story is, and they could end up being, you know, essentially dead or worth nothing. So if the woman wants to ensure that when she leaves the marriage, she gets back what she brought into it, what will happen is they will appraise the value of the asset she's bringing into the marriage. So let's say that they'll take the flock of, you know, of sheep to the expert flock appraiser. He'll say, there are 100 sheep here, each sheep is worth $100, so it's a $10,000 flock. And they'll actually, in the ksuba, they'll write, in addition to the ksuba, they will say, plus $10,000 in the form of sheep. And that sewn barzel, the iron sheep, means it's ironclad, it's set in stone, set in iron, that she'll get back $10,000 in the event of a death or divorce, regardless of what happens to the sheep. So that means that he is now absorbing and shouldering the risk of the sheep. If the sheep, if the flock grows and make lots of babies and there's a bigger flock, that's to his benefit. If the flock gets diminished, dies, appreciates, whatever it is, so then it's his loss, but she's protected. She still gets the same $10,000 that she value of dollars, in other words, that she brought into the marriage. So that's called sewn barzel because it's sort of set in iron the flock, and it applies to anything. It doesn't need to be sheep. It could be a sweater. It could be an apartment building, and so on. The point is, it's written in the contract, the ksuba, how much it's worth. The other kind of assets she can bring into the marriage are called nechse malug. Literally means like plucking property. Doesn't translate very well. It could be referring perhaps to the fact that he has what are called usufruct rights, meaning he has use of the fruit, the produce. He can pluck the fruit off the trees, etc., or pluck the shearings off the sheep. So in the same example we gave before, let's say she brings in this flock of 100 sheep into the marriage. She wants it not to be tzon barzel, she wants it to be nechse malug. That means that we won't appraise the sheep, and we won't give a dollar amount to it. But in the event that they get divorced, so then she will take her flock with her. If the flock had babies, she's richer. If the flock didn't have babies and lots of them died, she's poorer. But that's her prerogative to opt for that. Now, while they're married, this nechse malug, usufruct property, is part of the marriage, and he, the husband, has the rights to make use of what it produces. So if there's milk or there's wool, whatever it is, every year he can shear those sheep and make use of the wool. And, you know, when he sells the wool for $100, he can spend $100 whatever he wants, whether it's to take her out or spend it on himself and drink beer, that's his prerogative. So nechse malug, the plucking property, he can pluck, you know, off the peros, the production of this asset every year while they're married. So similarly, just to give a different example to make sure it's clear, if you're talking about like she brings a apartment building into the marriage, so if it's nechse malug, it means that every year the rent that collects goes to him to do as he sees fit. Another pshat in what malug is referring to the plucking is like when you remove the hide off of an animal, like when you're if you're making like leather, you basically skin the animal, and that malug, like you pluck it off the animal, it's like him, the husband, in the event of his divorce, like he essentially gets skinned and his what he had, they you know the real estate building that he had when his wife brought into the marriage, now gets plucked from him. So when she, those are two possibilities, nechse tzon barzel, nechse malug. In the event that a woman gets an inheritance or some kind of gift while she's married, so that automatically becomes nechse malug, meaning it's part of the marriage. While they're married, he has rights to make use of whatever it produces, but the corpus, the actual item itself, goes back to her in the event of a divorce. So the ksuba does say a little more than just the dollar amounts. It also sets a few other rights that she has, or better yet, obligations that he has to her. First of all, he has to provide her with mezonos. Mezonos, translated literally, would mean something like, you know, food and nourishment. That's certainly true. But it means all of her material requirements, which include also not just food, but also clothing, begadim, and also refua. He has to pay for her medical bills or her medicine and so on. That's his responsibility. So if he went away on vacation, left her behind, then she runs up a tab at the local grocery store. When he comes back, he has to pay her tab and so on, or her credit card bills and that kind of thing. In addition, he takes upon himself to redeem her, to ransom her in the event that someone stole her and is, you know, holding her for ransom. So then the husband is required to pay that ransom to get his wife back. That's part of the deal. He also has to provide her with ona, attention, and time, private time together, as well as he's responsible for kavura, her burial, which means not just the paying for the burial, but if he's alive, also to be mitapel, to be involved, to ensure the burial is done in a proper, timely, you know, respectable way. He's responsible to bury her. That's his responsibility. He takes it upon himself. And in the event that he dies, his estate will still provide for her mezonos, as well as the mezonos of her young daughters unmarried. As for him, he actually is entitled under normal circumstances to for her mitzios, things that she finds, as well as ma'asei yadeha, if she actually works, and then she contributes to the family budget, he essentially has use of that money also to decide how to allocate it. And again, if she gets anything during the marriage, like as a yerusha or something, so he has use of it while they're married. Okay, so that's the basic ksuba. Now, obviously, before I move on, I have to say the obvious, which is, while the ksuba does formalize sort of the obligations the parties, particularly the husband, has to the wife, that's certainly not what defines a marriage, right? A marriage is a lot more than what's in the contract. That would be a very sad marriage if all they really had interest in and claim upon was what was stipulated in the ksuba. That's just the bare minimum, and again, to protect the woman from those variety of things we discussed before. Now, one other topic I want to discuss to understand about this mesechta is when the obligation for ksuba kicks in. So there are two stages to marriage in Jewish law. One is called erusin, which is also referred to as kedushin. It's the same thing. And the other one is called nisuin. Now, these are difficult to translate in English exactly. Sometimes I translate erusin as engaged and nisuin as marriage in other recordings, but I always right away start hemming and hawing. That's a terrible translation, because it is a terrible translation. The truth is that they're both marriage steps, and a woman is fully married at erusin. Erusin, the kedushin, same thing. When the husband and wife agree to marry, and she agrees that she'll be his wife, and she essentially transfers the rights to marry her to him through kesef or shtar or bia. He gives the ring, etc., and she says, yes, I'm accepting the ring. In exchange, I'm committing myself to you that I will be only your wife. At that point, no one else can marry her. After Kedushin, after Erisin, she's a married woman. If someone would sleep with her, so they're liable to adultery. And we saw about another context we've seen in Midoraisa. If he's a Kohen, she could eat Truma, and so on and so forth. Now, although they're married, they're not living together. In the time of the Mishnah, there were these two stages. The first stage being Erisin was like when legally she becomes forbidden to everybody else, but yet they're not really living together as a husband and wife in a normal sense at all. Typically, she'd be living at home with her parents for a while, perhaps as long as a year, in which time she'd get ready for her marriage, preparing her wedding dress, and making other arrangements. Nisuin, the second stage of marriage, is largely a functional difference. It means that they're now living together with husband and wife in the more normal sense of the word. Now, to the it's a legalistic religion, of course, and we want to know exactly when Nisuin occurs. So the act which effects Nisuin is not a kinyan, like it was by Kedushin. Rather, it's something called chuppah. Now, what is chuppah? That is a large machlokas with a number of shitas. The word chuppah comes from the word like chipuy, a covering. And some understand that chuppah simply means that they have, but whatever, but we'll define exactly, the gist of chuppah and nisuin is that they are living together as husband and wife. They're doing what married people do, and not just legally committed and bonded, but they're actually living together as husband and wife. So what actually effect that is chuppah? So some learn the pshat simply as yichud. They're covered from the public eye. And that means that if they're in a, since Jewish men and Jewish women do not seclude themselves alone out of the public eye, yichud, being isolated from, you know, from public eye by themselves. So therefore, that's something that's reserved to, for married people. And so if the couple have yichud for whatever, 10 minutes, something like that. So then that's what, only a married thing to do, and therefore that indicates clearly that they're married. That's the beginning of nisuin. That's the act itself. This chuppah is not a euphemism for bia. That's not what it means. It's not the point at all. The point is simply that they are living as husband and wife, meaning like doing something in private. They're being in private together. Others learn that the chuppah is referring to being covered by like a canopy over them, as you see in weddings, you know, exactly that. So spreading that canopy over them is what does it. Perhaps he has to, it's a symbolic rishus, his like kind of private domain, and he has to bring her into it. A third shita is hinumia, like that he covers her, like the bedekin, he covers his bride, like, you know, dressing her essentially, drawing the veil over her face. The point is, since it's not normal for anybody to dress anybody else's wife, the fact that he's putting a veil on her face and dressing her is a symbolic act that says they're now husband and wife and functioning that way, and that would be considered a chuppah according to some, which would affect the nisuin. Everyone would agree, just to make sure this is clear, that if the wedding ceremony skipped the step of yichud, or there was no canopy, or there was no bedekin, but she moves in with them, they're living as husband and wife, then for sure everyone agrees that living together after Erisin makes them nisuin and they're married. No doubt about it. The question just is, what's the legal step which effects it first? And that's very important because the halacha of ksuba is that, the halacha anyways, is that the ksuba is only effective, her rights only kick in from nisuin, not from Erisin, not from Kedushin. Not when they commit to get married or whatever, they become legally bounded through Kedushin, Erizin, rather, but when they've nisuin, they really are functioning as husband and wife. And therefore, that's important to know exactly when it happens. But at all events, although there is a machlokas, if there's ksuba payable to after Erizin, the halach is certainly after nisuin only. Okay, so that really serves as like the basic introduction to the main themes, introductory themes of the Masechta. We have 13 prakim. They don't easily lend themselves to sort of describing the structure and topics of the Masechta, so I'll sort of do it kind of a little bit ad hoc, case by case, as we move through the prakim. We do have 13 prakim, and Be'ez Hashem, with that background, we'll be ready now to learn the Masechta inside. One final thing I do want to say is that the opening chapter of the Masechta deals with the definition of who's entitled to the kasuba of a besula, of a virgin, and therefore we define those terms quite technically, and it may not be appropriate recordings for mixed audiences. So I'll leave you, the listener, to use your good judgment to decide when and where to play these recordings.